is Friday, May 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Residents in Goma are told to evacuate after warnings that a second volcanic eruption may occur.
Volcanologists warned early on Thursday that in a worst-case scenario, a volcanic eruption under the lake, accompanied by an earthquake, could trigger a sudden release of carbon dioxide.
Plus, a UN Human Rights Council special session is dominated by calls for Israel to be held accountable for alleged abuses against Palestinians. We'll have these stories and more next. Residents of the Democratic Republic of Congo's eastern city of Goma have been told that evacuation is compulsory. It comes amid warnings that another volcanic eruption could occur with very little or with no warning at all. Reuters Nika Chile starts us off.
Nearby Mount Nyiragongo, one of the world's most active and dangerous volcanoes, erupted on Saturday. At least 31 people were killed and thousands left homeless, as some 17 villages were destroyed. The river of lava stopped just a few hundred meters short of Goma's city limits. Officials are now warning that magma has been detected beneath Goma and the adjoining Lake Kivu, and that an eruption could occur with very little or no warning. Volcanologists warned early on Thursday that in a worst-case scenario, a volcanic eruption under the lake, accompanied by an earthquake, could trigger a sudden release of carbon dioxide. Such an explosion could asphyxiate thousands of people, they said. Officials have said evacuation is compulsory, prompting people to head out of the city in cars, boats across Lake Kivu, or on foot, but some picking their way across a landscape charred by lava, still hot from Saturday's eruption.
Nika Chile from Reuters. UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Emergency Fund, welcomed the evacuation order, saying that as many as 400,000 people, including 280,000 children, could be displaced and are in need of protection or support. The agency also reports some 700 of the 1,000 children who were separated from their families following the first eruption have been reunited. However, an additional 142 children have been placed in transitional foster families, while 78 are in transit accommodation centers. More than 170 families are still looking for lost children. French President Emmanuel Macron on Thursday said France bears some responsibilities for the massacre of nearly 1 million Tutsis and moderate Hutus during the 1994 Rwandan genocide. He made the comments at a memorial in Rwanda to the genocide victims. While Macron did not apologize, he did say that France had failed the victims. Macron said that in backing the Hutu-led government at the time, France and other nations ignored warnings of massacres and attacks. And then he said that they did not act quickly enough to stop the killing. The French president's visit to Rwanda follows the release in March of the so-called Duclair Report, a study Macron's government commissioned into the history of the genocide. That report, based on the work of more than 100 historians, concluded that France, under then-President François Mitterrand, bore considerable responsibility for the massacre. For more on Macron's speech and the events that were leading up to it, my colleague Kate Pound-Dawson spoke with Jeffrey Mutagoma of VOA's Central African Service.
Well, he said quite a number of things. First of all, he stood with the genocide survivors who lost their beloved ones. He spoke at a genocide memorial site where hundreds of thousands of genocide victims are buried. And the location of the speech itself was significant. Then he said he acknowledged that France had a role and a history and political responsibility in Rwanda. And he acknowledged that by engaging in a conflict in which France had no prior experience, or by failing to hear the voices of those who warned of the genocide, its actions of wanting to stop what he called a civil war or a regional conflict inadvertently supported a genocidal regime. So that was the first thing he said. One was acknowledgement. And then in a more measured way. He talked about forgiveness and said it's only those who survived the genocide that would give a gift of forgiveness. He didn't straight away say that France was asking for forgiveness, but he did mention that the survivors could give a gift of forgiveness. And obviously he did mention the global responsibility, because even though he acknowledged France's responsibility, he did mention at some point that all of us failed.
How were his comments received there in Rwanda? Do you know? What are you hearing?
Well, from what I see, the social media comments, from what people are saying, and it appears like he has been successful in a way, if you like, in mollifying the genocide survivors who have been expecting him to apologize. Obviously, I suppose they also know that he wouldn't outrightly say we're having an apology. But the fact that, number one, he put that report, the Duclair report, which research, which came up with a report that unveiled what it did, and then he followed up with a visit to Rwanda, I think in the eyes of the genocide survivors is quite a positive thing. And obviously in the eyes of the Rwandan government is a step forward in the strained relations between both countries.
Now, you mentioned the strained relationship between the two countries. Is there any sign this visit will make a significant difference in that relationship?
After the Duclair report, we saw that President Kagame traveled to France. So President Kagame traveled to France and met Macron. And even when he was speaking to the press, he sounded very optimistic about the future of both countries. And his visit is now followed by President Macron's visit to Rwanda. And in his speech, he did seem to look forward, talking about supporting the generation, the future generation of historians, of researchers, and wishing that alongside France, all parties involved in the dark history the dark period of the Rwandan history would open up their archives and, you know, share that responsibility. So, but if nothing changes, I do think that this is a new chapter of France and Rwandan relations, looking at what has been transpiring in the past few days.
That was VOA Central African Service reporter Jeffrey Mutagoma speaking with my colleague Kate Pound Dawson. Roman Protasevich is the journalist jailed after his plane was forced to land on Sunday in Belarus by the government of President Alexander Lukashenko. Previously, the pro-democracy activists had decided to avoid flying over Belarus because of the risk of being intercepted. But according to a friend who was speaking to Reuters News, he let his guard down. Saroya Ali of Reuters News brings us that story.
Stepan Putsila, a friend and founder of the anti-government Next news outlet where Protasevich once worked, said they'd even discussed the risk of flying over Belarus.
But of course, no one expected this. No one could think that such a thing is possible in the modern world, that the plane would be told to land contrary to all international norms and standards. And such a step that has acquired such an international resonance, now all the media are writing about it. Of course it doesn't fit in my head.
Protasevich was a critic of Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko. He was on a passenger flight with his girlfriend back from a holiday in Greece to their homes in Lithuania on Sunday when the plane was diverted to Belarus after authorities flagged what turned out to be a hoax bomb threat. He is now in a jail in Minsk along with his girlfriend Sofia Sapega. Charges against him include organizing mass riots, and he faces up to 15 years in jail if convicted. They were both shown on state TV confessing to their alleged crimes, but opposition activists and his parents say they can see clear signs of torture on his face. Speaking to a Polish broadcaster, his father, Dmitry, said his son's holiday was a rare break from the intensity of his work at an anti-government news outlet.
It was his first holiday in 3 years. He did not want to go, but his friends simply forced him to go in order to rest, switch off.
Protasevich fled to Poland from Belarus in 2019 after feeling the heat from authorities, and ensured his parents relocated later too. In September, he moved to Lithuania's capital, Vilnius, which has become a hub for Belarusian opposition.
Reuters' Soroya Ali. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. A UN Human Rights Council special session to address the human rights situation in Palestinian territory was dominated by calls for Israel to be held accountable for alleged abuses. No European or North American country was among the more than 60 member states or observer states that supported the request. Lisa Schlein has the details.
UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bachelet opened the proceedings by recapitulating what she called the appalling events that led up to the special session. She noted 242 Palestinians, including 63 children, were killed by Israeli strikes on Gaza, and another 28 Palestinians, including 5 children, were killed in East Jerusalem. At the same time, she reported indiscriminate rocket fire launched by Hamas and other armed Palestinian groups from Gaza killed 12 Israeli citizens, including 2 children. She said the heavy rocket barrage triggered the 11-day clashes between Israel and Palestinians. She deplored the huge number of injuries and extensive damage to Gaza's infrastructure. She welcomed the May 21st ceasefire, but warned unless the root causes of this violence were addressed, future deadly eruptions would occur.
There must be a genuine and inclusive peace process to address these root causes and bring the occupation to an end. In the meantime, I reiterate my call on Hamas and all armed groups to refrain from use of indiscriminate rockets and mortars, for which there must be accountability. And once again, I urge Israel to ensure accountability in accordance with its obligations under international humanitarian human rights laws.
Special Rapporteur on the human rights situation in the Palestinian territory, Michael Link, acknowledged the indiscriminate attacks on civilians by both Israel and Hamas almost certainly violated international humanitarian law, but added the damage done by Hamas in Israel paled in comparison to that caused by Israel defense forces.
If we are not to meet again in yet another special session in a year or 3 years from now, then decisive steps must be taken now to fully end the occupation. Accountability is the key that can alone unlock the titanium cage that is the occupation.
Israel's ambassador to the United Nations in Geneva, Mera Elon Shahar, accused many countries at the session of presenting a moral equivalence between Israel, a democracy that abides international law, and Hamas, an extremist terrorist organization. She said the UN Council was biased against Israel.
Since the Council inception, 30% of all special sessions have targeted Israel. Instead of the Council being a moral voice, unequivocally stating that Israel has the right to defend itself and condemning Hamas for the terrorist activities, we have witnessed a ritual where Israel is targeted and singled out. It does not matter what are the facts and what is the reality on the ground.
Palestinian participants at the meeting, however, urged Council members to adopt a draft resolution calling for an independent international commission of inquiry to investigate all alleged violations of international humanitarian law in the Palestinian territory, including East Jerusalem and in Israel. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
China's U.S. embassy says that politicizing the origins of COVID-19 would hamper further investigations and undermine global efforts to curb the pandemic. The comment came after U.S. President Joe Biden ordered a review of intelligence about where the virus emerged. Reuters' Emer McCarthy takes it from here.
China's foreign ministry hit back at the United States on Thursday.
This shows that the U.S. does not care about facts or truth and has zero interest in a serious science-based study of origin. Their aim is to use the pandemic to pursue stigmatization, political manipulation, and blame shifting.
This comes after the Chinese embassy in Washington said in a statement Wednesday that some political forces have been fixated on political manipulation and the blame game. Biden said on Wednesday that U.S. intelligence agencies were divided about whether COVID-19 emerged from human contact with an infected animal or from a laboratory incident. As the WHO prepares to begin a second phase of studies into the origins of the coronavirus, China has been under pressure to give investigators more access amid allegations that it leaked from a Wuhan lab. China has repeatedly denied the lab was responsible.
With 33 million confirmed cases and 600,000 deaths from COVID-19 in the US, both the highest numbers in the world, the US doesn't reflect on its own problems, but rather attempt to make a scapegoat out of China. My question is, what are they up to? Can they sleep at night with an untroubled conscience?
A joint China WHO study published in March said it was highly unlikely the virus leaked from the lab, adding that it most likely spread from bats to humans via an unidentified intermediary species. China has also continued to point to the possibility that COVID-19 originated in another country and entered via infected frozen food or through Southeast Asian wildlife trade networks.
Emer McCarthy from Reuters. Mali's ousted interim leaders have been freed after they were detained by the army and resigned. Interim President Balan Dao and Prime Minister Mokhtar Ouanna were arrested and taken to a military base outside the capital on Monday, jeopardizing an 18-month transition back to democracy after a coup last August. International powers, including the United States and military ally France, worried about worsening security in Mali, and its neighbors have condemned the arrests and threatened sanctions. The arrests were orchestrated by Vice President Assimi Goïta, who led last year's coup. It's unclear if elections will take place next year, as promised. A senior State Department official warned on Thursday that Ethiopia and Eritrea should anticipate further actions from the United States if those stoking the conflict in Ethiopia's Tigray region fail to reverse course. Thousands have been killed and about 2 million people have been forced from their homes in Tigray after conflict erupted between the Tigray People's Liberation Front and the Ethiopian military in November. Troops from the neighboring Amhara region and the nation of Eritrea entered the war to support the Ethiopian government. The State Department's acting Assistant Secretary for the Bureau of African Affairs, Robert Godek, told the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that the security situation in Tigray has worsened in recent weeks, adding all armed parties have committed atrocities. The head of a Japanese doctors union said Thursday that holding the Olympic Games in Tokyo this summer with tens of thousands of people from around the world could lead to the emergence of an Olympic coronavirus strain. Meanwhile, the European Union and Japan on Thursday backed Tokyo's hosting of the Olympic Games this year, with EU-produced vaccines helping Japan in its battle against a fourth wave of infections.
This is Science in a Minute.
Most people think the universe is just a wild assortment of scattered galaxies. But scientists are finding evidence that elements of the universe are actually interconnected with each other by filaments made mostly of dark matter and gas. Since the proposed structure of this connected universe resembles an enormous spider web, it has become known as the cosmic web. A team of scientists recently used machine learning to create a map of dark matter in the observable universe. They say along with dark matter, it also shows several galaxy connecting filaments of the cosmic web that have not been previously discovered. According to the scientists, their new map could allow for future study of not only dark matter, but also provide new insight into the history and the future of our local universe. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The month of May is Mental Health Awareness Month in the U.S., and many Americans are being vaccinated and thinking about their hopes for their lives moving forward. VOA reporters spoke with Americans about what they've learned over the past year, and in this final segment of Alone Together, we hear from Nicole McKinney, Sherry Arnold, Madeline Arnold, Henry Johnson, Sayashi Little Dave, Catherine Lieberman, and Dave Arnold. They share what they're hoping to see and do after a year of trauma.
I can look at like the pandemic time as being a blessing because I really think that it helped myself and a lot of people that I know to slow down. It just gave me a time to really focus on one on myself and then my relationship with my husband and then the relationship with my daughter and my family.
Despite the circumstances of COVID-19, the one thing that I really appreciate is the time that I've been able to spend with my husband and with our daughter. We would not have had this type of in-depth time together under pre-COVID circumstances.
I know I've gotten to know like my mom and dad a lot more. So I feel like family time has been very important throughout this past year. So I feel like coming out of this, we'll all have this better sense of what family means to us.
When everyone is vaccinated and the infectious rates fall to near zero, I'm gonna host a huge barbecue. And I mean going all out, spend a whole paycheck on it.
Gosh, a vacation with my family and we don't have to worry. You know, we don't have to worry.
We've had some really good things come out of this about slowing down, about spending more time with each other, about finding new activities, new hobbies, new ways to take care of ourselves. And I would like us to not lose that.
I hope to spend a lot less time in the house. I want to see all the baseball I can. I want to eat a hot dog at a stadium.
My future hope would be two things. One is that everybody learns a little bit about letting go of things you can't control. And the other thing would be for people to take this as a learning lesson when it comes to mental health, to not be as judgmental. You know, everybody's struggling with something, you know, and if we can just be a little kinder and have a little more compassion, mental health wouldn't be as much of a stigma as it is.
I'd say that my life has improved because of COVID-19, only in the fact that it's made me aware of some of my vulnerabilities. I've gone from someone who doesn't believe in anything to someone who passionately sees every day the existence of virtue in our society by little things like, you know, neighbors wearing masks or, you know, communities respecting each other's distances. You know, like, those are small sacrifices, but it shows an awareness of both the value of themselves and the world in which they live. You know, when you see that, that has been very comforting to me.
Hopefully this will make us better people and a better nation moving forward. That it'll make us kinder in the long run, because we've all, as a world, have experienced this great trauma. And how can we be better, a better society moving forward, and make connections that are positive and not try and hurt each other?
My hope is that just enough of us learn lessons so that in the future we can do it better. I hope that the government is learning how to handle a pandemic better, just in case another one comes relatively soon. We had 100 years between the last two major pandemics. If we learn the lessons and we improve it so that next time it's not as bad.
What I hope will come out of this is people will realize that we're all in this together. People can have different opinions about a lot of things, but we just, I think, have lost sight of that how much we do have in common. And I hope that that will have some impact on us going forward as a nation and as a world population.
And finally, the United States, China, and Western European governments have announced their intention to retool their automobile industries, moving away from cars that burn fossil fuels like gasoline and oil to electricity-powered vehicles. Experts say that this will help mitigate climate change and prove lucrative for businesses who adapt early to so-called clean energy. But what will that transition mean for Africa and other parts of the developing world that rely on oil and gas to fuel their economies? Now, to find out more about what this change may mean for Africa's oil and mineral sectors and for the continent as a whole, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Michael Ross, a professor of political science at the University of California, Los Angeles.
It'll have enormous implications for Africa. There's a number of countries that depend heavily on exports of oil and natural gas to keep their economies going. Nigeria, Angola, Congo Brazzaville, South Sudan, Equatorial Guinea, Chad, and so on. And these countries tend to have oil that is not particularly cheap to extract.
So what does that mean?
What that means is, as demand goes down globally for petroleum, places where it's more expensive to take it out of the ground are going to see demand drop much more quickly. And the governments are going to have a lot less money, and it's going to be much harder for them to pay their bills. And they're going to have to find other ways to produce jobs and fund their governments and fund public services.
You mentioned before that mineral wealth is both a blessing and a curse when it comes to Africa. How might that also be the case when so much of the world changes over to electric vehicles from gas?
Countries that have abundant sources of so-called critical minerals, the minerals that are rising in demand as we move toward electric vehicles, they're going to see a big increase in the demand for what they mine. And that potentially means new investment, jobs, government revenues will potentially give governments the opportunity to provide more services, but also probably fund a lot more corruption and could cause political fortunes in those countries to get worse.
But there'll be lots of job loss along the way for workers in the oil fields and other places in the petroleum industry.
Well, the good thing about the minerals industry is that it tends to employ more people. And so there are going to be more people who directly benefit. And for better or worse, mining happens on land. A lot of oil extraction takes place offshore. So you're going to have both more opportunities for local peoples to benefit from new infrastructure, from jobs, from providing services to companies that are working in these areas, but also more environmental degradation and potentially more land disputes and more human rights abuses. So it's kind of a mixed picture.
You mentioned the DRC as an example.
The Democratic Republic of Congo has a long history of political instability, political repression, and is by and large a country that is not likely to spend the money well. So we should be pretty suspicious about what the larger consequences will be. And it's possible that in countries that have strong governments and where people have some ways of holding their governments accountable might benefit. They might indeed get a larger share of the proceeds. But that's a country-to-country struggle, and often it's an uphill battle for citizens to claw some of these benefits out of their governments and out of the hands of the international companies that are operating there.
Historically, there hasn't been a lot of transparency over how the money that's made from these resources, minerals and oil, etc., is spent or where it goes.
Yes, that's right. The whole extractive sector, oil, gas, minerals, timber, is clouded by very high levels of secrecy. People don't have the opportunity to find out who's really benefiting. But when the secrecy is peeled back every once in a while, we see all kinds of sweetheart deals, all kinds of corruption with these contracts. So it's not inevitable, but we need to, I think, start from a position of wariness about the benefits that flow to everyday citizens. And Africa's oil wealth has been the entry point for all kinds of pernicious foreign influences ever since the colonial era. And it's one reason why their resources are as often a curse as a blessing. They're undoubtedly a blessing for the governments and the people in power who can capture a large share of it. But it's much rarer that the people on the ground actually benefit.
That was UCLA political science professor Michael Ross speaking with our own Adam Phillips, who after 28 years at VOA retires today. He's been a great friend and colleague, and he'll be missed. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.